Are you ready for tricky market-based interview questions? If not, this video is for you. Here, we're going to cover three highly technical questions that came from actual JP Morgan investment banking interviews. Stick around to see how we answer them. If you have a JP Morgan investment banking interview coming up, you should know that JP Morgan is known for having really tough technical questions, especially as it pertains to the market. So if you don't know what's going on in the economy, what the trends are, you don't have specific examples prepared beforehand, well, good luck to you. In this mock interview, my colleague David and I are going to go through some mock interview questions that came from actual JP Morgan investment banking interviews. So a way for you to practice is after he asks the question, pause the video, try to answer on your own, and then you can see how I would answer that question.
All right, Annie. So thank you for joining me for the interview here today. And to kick things off, I just want to know really why JP Morgan? What's your interest in our bank?
Yeah, hi David, really nice to meet you. So most of what I learned about JP Morgan is actually from one of my mentors at the Finance Club. So her name is Stephanie. She actually did a summer analyst program here at JP Morgan. So a lot of what I do know is from her experience as a summer analyst. And then she got a full-time offer. From what I've gathered, you know, one of the things that stand out about the JP Morgan experience from a very junior level is that I would be able to have a really broad range of different experiences. So what Stephanie told me, Stephanie was my mentor, is that she was staffed on a live deal, which is obviously a big deal. And she was able to not only do the qualitative aspects, so participating in management meetings, obviously taking notes for the investor presentations and all of that, and creating the whole pitch deck, doing the industry research. But she was also able to do a lot of the technical aspects as well, such as working on the actual model. So she told me about how she did a couple of different financing cases. Obviously, the analyst that was overseeing her proofread all the stuff and made sure the model tied and all that. But I just thought, what an incredible opportunity to get that level of responsibility and ownership from a super junior level. So that's something that I value, is being able to have that taste, that real taste of investment banking, even as an intern. And then, of course, something different, something that stands out to me about JP Morgan is I've always considered investment banking and just finance in general as quite conservative, except of course if you're in like fintech, right? Because that pushes you to be in the technology space. But overall, I think investment banking is quite conservative as an industry. And I really appreciate how JP Morgan has always been at the forefront of what's coming up. Like there's a lot of talk about Jamie Dimon pursuing the ESG initiatives and also his emphasis on adopting AI into the workplace, how to best leverage that for the changing economy. So I definitely want to be in an environment where we're at the forefront of whatever is next. I think that's a very exciting place to be.
Excellent. Well, no, I think that makes a lot of sense. And it's clear, Annie, that you've done quite a lot of research. So that's great to hear. And it's also great to hear that your own personal connections have been able to represent our bank well. So awesome stuff and great to hear it. Thanks for sharing that.
For
Now,
sure.
getting a little bit more technical with our questions here, I just want to know, Annie, what are your thoughts on the current state of the market?
Yeah, I mean, I think that is a very contested question. I think there are a lot of people with different views. Some are more dramatic than others. So I've actually been following Anu Iyengar quite a lot. She's the global head of M&A. And I resonate with a lot of what she's been saying. So she was at a women's conference earlier last week, and she spoke about how, you know, a lot of the major issues still hasn't been resolved. For example, inflation hasn't come down to where the Fed's wanted them to be. But because there's a path towards it, there's a lot more confidence in the CEO space, which has encouraged a lot of M&A activity. It has encouraged a lot more activity in the ECM, DCM markets. So granted, we are in the middle of two land wars. You know, there are things happening, but her general sentiment is that the consumer and the CEO confidence is high. And so even though there are pending issues, there's more security, and that's lending to more activity. On the same note, I know Jamie Dimon was at the JP Morgan Leveraged Finance Conference last month. He echoed pretty much the same sentiments about confidence being high. I was surprised to hear that because generally he has very bearish views, as you may know. So for him to come up with a, I would say, cautiously optimistic outlook was surprising. But I think it is an indication that, you know, just from a lot of people that I've talked to, I would say it's probably more of a soft landing than the dramatic crash, like the worst financial crash that you'll ever see. So generally, I'm optimistic. Now, of course, I have done a lot of just researching online and talking to people. I'm curious if that is what you're seeing on the desk right now, David.
Yeah, absolutely, Anya. No, that's great. I'm happy to discuss that, exactly kind of what we're seeing on our desk and from our viewpoint more broadly. You know, at a very kind of a high level, when we're thinking very macroeconomically, you know, what I would say is that largely what we're seeing is just themes that are contributing to a normalization coming off of the extreme effects of COVID. You know, obviously it's been about 4 years now, or coming up on the 4 year anniversary since, you know, the shutdowns began and you know, all these emergencies were declared. And so obviously it's been quite a long time since then, but these things tend to move pretty slow through the economy. And so what I think that we've been experiencing, particularly in 2022 and 2023, is that normalization into a post-COVID environment. And so one of the ways that we're kind of seeing that the most is through things like the CPI and the jobs reports that we get each month. So of course, throughout 2022 and most of 2023, we had seen inflation slightly ticking lower. We got all the way down to about a 3.1% tick in January of 2024. And then that started to turn back up in February. We saw a 3.2% print in the CPI. And at the same time, the December and January jobs reports, these were both seen to be a little bit weakening. So, you know, originally they had reported very strong numbers, suggesting strong economic growth here in the US and high labor demand, even as inflation was reducing. But what we're kind of starting to see right now is reductions in these job additions, especially if you look at the revisions in each monthly report. You know, February we saw 275,000 jobs added. But if the trend continues like January and December, then I think that we could expect to see some reductions in that overall amount. Now, we'll of course get the March data at the end of next week, so that'll kind of give us an answer on that front. But I think overall, those are contributing to the normalization in the normalization of the economy in the post-COVID environment, like I mentioned. But what makes it really interesting is that, as you may know, the Federal Reserve did just meet last week on Wednesday, and they decided to maintain the benchmark interest rates here in the U.S., the federal funds target range, in the 5.25 to 5.5% range. Now, originally, back in 2023, everybody was anticipating that they might start to begin cutting interest rates at this level. That higher for longer narrative seemed to have kind of run dry, but that's not what the Federal Reserve decided to do. Ultimately, they did end up maintaining rates in the same range. Now, the long-term outlook of rates has kind of ticked higher a little bit, or at least the higher for longer scenario has extended itself, I guess would be a more accurate way to describe it. And so what many people are anticipating now is that rate cuts wouldn't really start to impact the economy until the July meeting. And so we have started to see an uptick in activity, especially in the IPO and the M&A market. You may have seen Reddit just IPO'd recently, and then we've seen other large companies like Stripe, Shein, and others of the same kind of stature start to indicate an interest to go public relatively soon. So it seems like these companies are starting to get a little bit more used to the high rate environment. And if we look even more broadly than just the post-COVID environment, going all the way back to the GFC and the beginning of the ZIRP era of interest rates, what we're seeing with rates back in the 5% range-ish, that's more so a normalization to historical US trends. So it seems like these companies are starting to get a little bit more used to what we historically have seen in the pre-GFC environment. And we would expect that to continue. Now, we are still expecting rate cuts, at least three cuts before the end of the year, down to the 4.5 to 4.75% range. But along with that, it's great to see that these companies are starting to normalize a little bit with the current interest rate environment.
Well, thank you for that context. I mean, I'm really looking forward to being, as well versed in what's happening in the market like you are.
Absolutely. Yeah,
Thank you
you know,
so much.
we have some great resources, you know, that love to keep us updated. And I would love to be able to kind of show you around a lot of that stuff if you do have an interest in what's going on with markets. But that's
Thank you.
excellent stuff then, Annie. Now, moving on to our next question here, I'm going to keep it a little bit technical. You know, I and you just talked a lot about interest rates there. So I'm just wondering if you could explain to me exactly how interest rates tend to affect markets.
So from what I understand, if you have a higher interest rate, that would increase the cost of borrowing, especially on the debt side. So that directly impacts the DCM market because that also affects how affordable the debt could be to the different companies. So if I think about it from the corporate side, if a company has less access to capital, less available access to debt, they may grow not in as fast of a manner as it could, right? So it could stifle growth in a lot of different manners. It could also cut expenses because now they're looking to squeeze capital from their firm because they can't get it from an external source. So not only does it hamper the top line growth, but they could look to cut expenses, may incur some layoffs, maybe cut down their resources, not invest as much in their capital development, right? So less CapEx spend. So overall, investing less in their core operation. And I think what that will do to the broader environment is they're probably, it's because they're growing less fast, right? They're going slower. The investor may perceive it at a lower valuation. So there may be less investor interest. And broadly, I know this is a really broad extension, but this could slow down the M&A markets as well. You know, if we look to the broader valuation, the context of valuation, I know the cost of borrowing is a heavy impact, has a heavy impact on the discount rate. So what this could mean is, let's say a company is planning to exit in the next year or so, right? They may be using a way inflated discount rate because their cost of borrowing is higher, which means their discount rate is higher. And so their valuation, their immediate valuation may be much lower. That being said, I do understand that discount rates typically is looking more towards the long term. So the effects may be less dramatic, as I just mentioned, but I still think it has some influence over what people think the long-term interest rate may be. So I hope that answers your question.
Absolutely. No, I think that's an excellent summary of how that would be impacting our desk, especially there. It's clear, once again, that you've done quite a lot of research before this, which we certainly appreciate. Now, keeping the questions a little bit technical, but moving into your own personal experiences a little bit more, you know, I see that you have some great experience from this past summer. So if you wouldn't mind, please just tell me about a deal that you worked on over the summer, how you contributed to that deal, what were the costs, what were the sources of funds, and any other details you think might be relevant.
Yeah, so I worked in a boutique investment bank in Los Angeles last summer, and we focused really on real estate and particularly in the gaming industry. So one example that I was involved with, it was actually a deal that was not live, but became live during my 2 months at the company. It was a smaller casino looking to acquire another casino in the Midwest. Just to give you a sense, it was $500 million in EBITDA. They were trading at a 6x multiple, and it was pretty in line with the rest of the industry. So it was a standard, more like, that we were trying to raise debt for the acquisition. And so I would say it's a pretty general, like standard M&A deal. There weren't a lot of crazy things happening on it. But in terms of my responsibilities on the deal, so I helped definitely help the analysts with the pitch deck, the investor presentation and all of that. So I was in charge of researching the industry. We did a lot of research on different comps. So the challenge with that is a lot of these companies are quite private. So not only did we have obviously a public comp set and we had to discount it to fit our needs, we also did a somewhat of a private comp set, obviously with less, because all these information is confidential, but we did a general landscape of, you know, these are the, it's more like a competitive profile of these are the consumers, this is the range of products. So it was really interesting to see, you know, how we can do comps for both public comps and then also for the private companies more relatable in that space. So there's a lot of the qualitative aspects of helping with the pitch deck. On the quantitative side, I was really lucky that we had a very lean deal team. So I got to observe the analysts do a lot of the modeling. And I actually was able to model alongside him. So even though we ran with his main model in the main, you know, Excel, right? But on the side, I was able to model out three different cases. So we had different financing cases. We had different operational cases, a downside-based case, and also upside case. And I also was able to observe how we can switch up the different financing scenarios. Like maybe it was we used a loan to finance it. What if we used a public bond to finance this deal, right? So there was all these different combinations that we could work with. And I was able to see how that impacted the rest of the model.
Excellent. Well, like I said, you know, that all sounds like a great experience. Great to hear that it was a lean team, so you got a little bit more responsibility than you otherwise may have anticipated. Now, that's all excellent stuff then, Annie. So I want to move on to a little bit more of the behavioral style questions here now. So starting more broad, want to keep things pretty open-ended here. Just tell me, what makes you stand out against your competitors, and what have you done that no one else could do?
Well, I can't speak directly to our competitors because I don't know who they are, but I would say something that is really unique to my experience is at my university, at Wharton, there is a student-run credit union. So what that effectively means is everyone from the teller all the way to the CEO and the chairman are actually current students. So I was lucky enough to be able to be involved in this organization. I started like a teller like everyone else in my freshman year. And at this stage of my undergrad, you know, I have progressed. I literally experienced every sector of the credit union. So it's a nonprofit bank, essentially. So I did the teller, the member services aspect. I did the loans. You know, I was a loan officer. I was in the investment committee. Mm-hmm. I was even in the back end audit. So I had a taste of every single aspect of a bank. Wow. And currently, my role is the chief lending officer. So I actually run a team of 20 students. 10 of them are loan officers, and then 10 of them are credit analysts, essentially. And we're running a $500,000 mini fund. There's a lot of loan syndicates. So I think that that experience makes me a pretty unique candidate, because I don't know a lot of people who've had that much exposure to all the different areas of the bank. And just from that, what I've learned about what I like, what I really enjoy, is I really do enjoy the debt aspects. You know, as the role of chief lending officer, that's all I do, right? It's evaluating loans, evaluating debt, evaluating the credit worthiness of an individual's, and then making educated predictions about someone's default rate, right? If this is a good loan to issue out. Which is why I'm particularly drawn to investment banking, and especially here in leveraged finance, because I understand that it's exactly that, except instead of giving a loan out to a person, an individual, we're giving loans out to these big corporations. And I really enjoy, you know, that sense of, first of all, the technical aspect of what it would take to evaluate debt, mm-hmm. and also the implications of what it could do, not only to help a person, but a corporation, a big Fortune 500 corporation.
Excellent. No, that, like you said, a very unique experience there. So that's great to hear that you've seen all different sides of a bank and gotten the opportunity to figure out what aspects you like, what you don't like. That's just, like I said, a great experience to have there. So I appreciate you sharing that as well.
Thank you.
Now, in keeping with these more behavioral style questions, you know, this one might get a little bit more sensitive, you know, always one of my favorites to ask, but just tell me about a mistake you made. And of course, the life lesson that you learned from that mistake.
Oh, gosh. Actually, this is very real and fresh in my mind. So I wouldn't say I'm proud of it. Obviously, it's a mistake. So this happened in my last internship, and it was quite a unique situation because I was a very lean deal team. I was literally staffed with, it was like me, a VP, and the managing director. And it was quite a simple assignment that I had messed up on. So I'll give you a little bit more context. We had a client meeting coming up. And it was just a one-page assignment that I was assigned to do, basically listing the EBITDA of all of our competitors, right? So we're going to meet with a bank, with a firm, and then we had a comparative, a comp analysis just based off EBITDA and, you know, different multiples off of that. And, well, one of the more senior analysts had told me, you know, one of the most important things to do as an analyst is to source all of the data. So as I'm finding the figures, to really footnote it where I found it. And if I could find the source for it, then it's good, right? Because then you can back it up and prove it. So that's something that I've kept in the back of my mind. And I did this. I sent it to my VP. He looked over my sourcing. It looked fine. And then we just sent it to the MD for his presentation in the morning. Now, the mistake of that was the EBITDA was all wrong. So obviously that was a huge, like, it was not fun for the MD, because then he had to explain, you know, how his analyst messed up, and then he had to like figure out a way. I heard about it afterwards. But the mistake was that not actually that what I did was wrong. It was more so of, and I'm sure you've seen this, in a filings, there's so many different types of EBITDAs. There's like the adjusted EBITDA, pro forma EBITDA, further adjusted EBITDA. And for me, I had no context of the assignment. So I just found the number that I felt was most right. And I sourced it, and I kind of like, you know, delegated the responsibility to my VP. Like in my mind, I was thinking, you know, if this is wrong, he's going to catch it. Right. So there's also the lack of full ownership on my behalf. So what I learned, a really valuable lesson, is really to think the bigger picture. So in this case, it was, you know, this guy's going to, the MD is going to a client meeting. And so he'd be presenting numbers of other firms that they probably want their investors to know. So where's the best place to look for that? The investor presentation, right? I probably wouldn't have gone so minute in the details with the filings, but I know that's a very specific example. It's just the broader lesson for me. Something to keep in mind for my further roles is, even though I'm an analyst and I'm scrubbing on the numbers and deep into the details, deep into the weeds, I really need to, you know, what is the big picture? Think about, what is the big picture of this? What is the goal of this entire exercise? And then from there, determine how much in the weeds I need to get and where I need to find the information.
Right. Well, no, I think that makes a lot of sense. And I appreciate you sharing that example as well. You know, of course, those kinds of mistakes certainly happen to the best of us. I'm just glad that you were able to take responsibility, accountability, and ownership of the mistake and turn it into that life lesson as you described right there. So I once again appreciate you sharing that, Annie.
Thank you.